Comments made on the Serotalk Podcast Network are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotalk Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers.
Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast.
Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast, your portal to the accessible digital lifestyle.
www.serotalk.com,
a production of Serotalk Corporation, makers of System Access, the System Access Mobile Network, and SA2Go. Learn about new technology, cool software, useful websites, education, information, entertainment, user comments, and much more. And now, here's your host, Jamie Pauls.
Welcome to Serotalk Podcast 108 for May 14th, 2012. I'm Jamie Pauls.
I'm Ricky Enger.
I'm Joe Steinkamp.
Awesome.
Well, wait a minute. It almost wasn't Jamie Pauls.
Exactly.
Really weird.
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to be Jamie and Buddy was going to be me and something was going to happen.
Yeah.
We just...
Freaky the internet, Friday. I saw that movie. It's cool.
Yeah. Right. The internet is mean to us sometimes, is it not?
It is.
In many, many ways.
It was mean to Serotalk, and we'll talk about that first, and then I'll tell you why it was mean to me. So, Joe, why don't you tell us what happened to Serotalk over the weekend?
So, you're actually hearing us, which is good, because for certain points of the weekend, you might not have been able to hear us. Now, before you come up with any crazy tinfoil hat conspiracy theories that Joe likes to mention on these here old podcasts... PodTrack, the service that actually does a lot of tracking for thousands and thousands of podcasters like ourselves, decided to change the way that they do things. And because of that, it messed up some of our shows on SPN. So
yeah, the developers decided, oh, nobody ever uses mixed case URLs for their file names. You wouldn't have capital end, capital of, capital line. So we'll just, you know, make it so people can't do that anymore. And it was quite interesting,
surprise,
the outcry that happened. You got Sword and Laser, which is Veronica Belmont and Tom Merritt, and you know, a whole group of other podcasters who were saying, we're going to have to go back and edit hundreds of feeds just so people can get to
our archives,
each episode of the podcast.
So it was made to make things easier for people that are doing cross-promotion through FeedBurner and things like that. What it ended up doing, though, was knocking a whole bunch of us offline until it was fixed. So we got in a lot of iReports over the weekend. We thank everybody for that. It did actually alert us to the problem to go investigate and then to kind of go, oh, wait a minute.
This hey, PodTrack, you broke us.
Yeah. And that whole weekend, if you'd searched for PodTrack, P-O-D-T-R-A-C, in Twitter, you would have found the hashtag fail next to a lot of it. And that some other shows as well, as we'll talk about later in the show. But it is important that if you guys do hear that there are problems with a feed on iBlink Radio, let us know and we'll try and let the show that is in iBlink Radio know that there's a problem. But understand that iBlink Radio is an aggregator and that we don't control those feeds. So letting us know is important, but it's not necessarily something that we can control through the service.
Well, I was almost late to the party this week. My internet was kind of online and kind of off. It would just drop for like 30 seconds at a time, and I would not be online, and then it would come back. And that's rather inconvenient.
Are you part of that Dixie Cup philosophy of just streaming?
Yeah.
And
can you hear me now?
Yeah, there you go.
So
yeah.
I frustrated a lot of AT&T tech support people because I couldn't see the little flashing lights on my modem. It's amazing how really disturbed they get. I mean, there are other ways to tell whether you're online or not. And I get it. There are some codes on some of those things that they need to know what they are. But some of the techs, because I actually talked to several over a course of about 3 days, were understanding and worked with me, and a couple were kind of rude. And it's like, well, I can't help you if you can't see the lights. I'm sorry.
So, yeah, there's not a portion in the script for that, which is unfortunate. I mean, that's a part of accessibility that we don't often talk about is how do you train the layman who is supposed to be supporting you as a technical person to work with you in a way that, you know, both of you can get the answers that you need.
Right.
This does come up at least most often with this kind of thing. Can you see the lights on the modem and that sort of thing? What color is this one blinking? I don't know. Is there any other way I can figure that out?
So what you're saying is we need a really good light probe app for the iPhone, huh?
That would be good. There are actually light detector apps, although the problem, I don't believe that there is one that can, A, distinguish the color of the light, and B, you've got several lights that are in very close proximity to each other, so it could be a real challenge to point it at the right thing and understand this is the third light from the left, and this is what its label is. And I think it's kind of unfortunate because in some of these tech support scenarios, you're almost required to know more than the technical support person on the other end just in order to tell them, you know, how you can go about doing this thing in a roundabout way.
My favorite AT&T DSL one is read me the number that's circled as shown in this diagram.
Oh, cute.
Because that's your router key and you have to flip over your modem and actually find this number amongst like three or four other groups of numbers. Doing that one without vision assistance is, let's just put it this way. You'll write that number down and keep it in a very safe place.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, as it turns out, lightning struck in the main office in my area. So I went and bought a new modem, which was one of the things that was recommended that I try, which actually wasn't a bad thing because it was kind of old. People were talking. It's like, man, the internet's been kind of weird this week. And I'm thinking, what an interesting piece of information for me to have. And finally, when I talked to the advanced tech guy yesterday, he actually traced it down and they fixed it. And I'm back online and happy, and I'm going to upgrade to UVerse. So I'm going to be about times the speed that I was. And so I'll be happy here very shortly. So
at least you weren't late to the party, like, I don't know, a screen reader to RIM.
Oh, yeah. A free screen reader for RIM. You know, it's kind of funny because on the last podcast, Ricky talked about, okay, why do we care? Why do we talk about these things? RIM, you know, it's not accessible. Well, all of a sudden, maybe it kind of is if you care.
Yeah. Well, there are...
The word caveats
I'm not sure where
comes
to start
to mind.
With this. Yes.
caveats.
That's for sure. Yeah. I have to commend RIM for coming to the party and making the screen reader available for free to BlackBerry subscribers. I think it's, you know, well past time that happened. And thank you, RIM, for doing this. The problem is that the browser itself does not appear to work here. You look at the documentation for the screen reader, and it basically says, here, you can go get documentation for how to use this device from a desktop computer, so you can't read this in the browser on the device itself. That's a bit unfortunate, especially given that browsing is something that really is quite handy on a phone. Oratio, which was the screen reader developed in partnership with RIM and sold through Humanware, and I believe Code Factory was involved to some degree with this as well. Hopefully I have my history right. But in any case, that is no longer being sold. And I'm kind of curious, did RIM take a ground-up approach and build an entirely new screen reader? Or did they say, we're going to take what we have with Oratio and just not sell it anymore and make it available for free on our devices?
Right.
That is an interesting question. I think you have to toss that into the number of handsets that are supported by both versions.
And which maybe are approximately two.
Yeah, so you can draw some conclusions there.
Yeah, so you're not going to be able to use this on something like the Playbook, which is the tablet. This supports a couple of the BlackBerry Curve models. And again, we do want to say thank you to RIM, but understand that there are some caveats associated with this.
Yeah, and like with any platform, you're going to have need for developers to do work in order to really help support your platform. RIM is in a situation right now where they're moving to the BlackBerry OS 10. They've got some new hardware. We've talked about this before, about RIM and where they are up against the world of mobiles. And so it's great that this is happening. It's great if you're in a corporation who is still using BlackBerry and these are still options to you, because we have to remember that while we personally might not choose that for the device that we want to use in our everyday lives. There are people who do have to use these for employment situations, and that this option is very near and dear to them. So we make a little light here, but we also recognize that there are people in situations that have to use phones that are may or may not be accessible due to security reasons or governance from their IT department or what have you. Not everybody can have an iPhone in every situation. So that's why we talk about this, or when Nokia makes a screen reader free for Symbian and things like that, because there are organizations that don't necessarily upgrade as fast on phones.
If you are one of the people who does have to use BlackBerry in your employment situation, let us know what you think about the new screen reader.
Yeah, and that you're out there. I mean, in all seriousness, because it would be interesting to know who in the blind community really is using this product.
Or Windows phones.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, Skype is going to kill those.
Yeah, I don't think it's just going to be Skype. Oh, insert rim shot here.
So what about this article that maybe some sellers are not real happy about Skype being included? I guess I don't quite get this, because you can put Skype on your iPhone. So what's the – is it just the lack of sales – to begin with on Windows Phone?
I think the deal is here really that with Windows phones, the carrier can choose the types of apps that are included by default here. And Skype is among them on Nokia phones right now. And, you know, some of the carriers are like, oh no, this is going to totally kill our business model and everything else. And there's a response here, which basically states we have to come to the understanding that Skype is everywhere. VoIP services are everywhere, not just Windows phones. You can get this on your iPhone, your Android device, and so on. So we have to decide if you still want to monetize, which of course they do, let's think of a different way to do this. You can't put the genie back in the bottle and say, you know, VoIP is just not going to be on this phone. You've got to come up with some other way to make money in that situation.
Cell phone companies don't want to become ISPs. I mean, that's the in for what we're saying here. Cell phone companies don't want to become internet service providers. That's what ISP is. And they don't want to be the guy that shifts data from one spot to another. That doesn't make nearly as much money as text messages. So when you have the AT&T CEO coming out and kind of fearing iMessage and talking about other services like that that are walking around the ability for the cell phone companies to find ways to charge you, again, the traditional business model has changed. It's no different than the TV industry doesn't want you to get everything through Netflix. It's the same way that you have other business models that we've grown accustomed to in newspapers, you know, don't want you to have RSS feeds because they can't monetize the same way. It's all about who controls the data and how they can, you know, provide ads and where ads can come from. And how they can upsell you on charges.
Hang on, I have to let my cat out. Sorry.
Yeah, well, you know, it's hard to convince you to go to a family data plan and give you, say, 300 text messages instead of 100 if you say, you know what, we all have iPhones, we'll just iMessage back and forth. So there's a lot to this.
Well, speaking of a phone that isn't dying anytime soon, you know, we're always looking at articles that are maybe semi-well written or not well written at all. So it was kind of nice to see an article with the title, How the Blind Are Reinventing the iPhone. Kind of a catchy headline. But the story actually features Maria Rias and Lynette Tatum. Many of you listening would be familiar with these ladies from Blind Cool Tech. And they also have their own podcast, or at least have had. I don't know if it's still going or not. I need
I'm
to
not sure.
double check
the
that.
Malin. Oh, that's right. There we go. What they called it. Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent. And basically, I thought the author of the article did a really good job of explaining how voiceover works for, because this was a mainstream article. Mainstream publication. So I actually thought that person did a good job of kind of explaining how voiceover works and how we as blind people use this technology.
Yeah, it's a neat little article, and it does talk about using GPS and, of course, playing music and all of the typical things that one does with one's iPhone. It's good in some ways to see this kind of thing in the mainstream, because even though articles like this are often written from the perspective of, you know, look at these people and how they use this wonderful technology to make their lives better. And there's always some degree of condescension in articles like this. But I think this one was done in such a way that the idea of a blind person using an iPhone wasn't made to seem alien or impossible or anything like that. It was just, these people are doing the same types of things that you do.
Right.
And it's also a situation where let's flash back to pre-3GS. You still have a lot of people who would have thought, it's just a piece of glass. How could they interact with a piece of glass, not knowing that hitting, you know, the home button three times will bring up a screen reader? So it's one of those things where it is just about making people aware more than anything else that exists and getting it
exactly
out there. Because
yeah,
on the face of it, you know, unfortunately, it happens that a lot of people judge a book by its cover. And so just by touching that phone or using that phone constantly, and remember that without VoiceOver, the iPhone has a very sensitive touch layer, and it is extremely fast, and it moves and scrolls and pinches and zooms and makes things bigger and all this other stuff really, really, really fast. When you turn on VoiceOver, a lot of that stuff is kind of silenced. A lot of that stuff is kind of deadened. There's a layer between the layer of the touch layer. In other words, the iPhone has been really thought of for a blind user and how you would interact with that screen. Sighted people don't think of it in the way that we would, using pick, flick, and panning and stuff like that. So it's great to get that out there.
Exactly. And I've had people, I'd be on a plane and people are walking by, you know, getting off the plane, and I'm standing there checking my voicemail or something as I'm leaving, and they're, excuse me, I just have to ask, how are you using this device? And it's not something that's easily explained in a couple of seconds, but it is something that the more articles we see like this, the more commercials that we see with blind people using standard technology, the less this is actually going to become a big deal to people. It's going to look natural.
Or it's a conversation starter. My Aunt Gertie, my grandmother, yes, has vision issues. How can I see you have an iPhone? I could get her an iPhone. How does that work? And it's a great opportunity for us to advocate to other people about the wonders of what we have now, which is not something that we've had. It's something we've dreamed about, and it's certainly something we've talked about at Saratech for years and years. And now that we've got it, it's great to see that there are avenues for us to be able to use to be able to involve other people who might not be familiar with visual impairment with the technology that we use, the same technology they're holding in their pocket.
So our next article then is written from a blind person's perspective, and this one kind of left me wanting a little more. Why Mac computers are becoming more favorable among the blind. Fair headline. It basically mentions everything good, but doesn't take any time to say, hey, this is what, you know, areas maybe we'd like to see improvement or things we'd like to see coming. Maybe that wasn't the intent of the writer. It seemed to me that it just kind of ended, and I would have liked to have seen more. I mean, for example, they talk about things like, assistive tech integrated. You know, you can go to the help files and stuff like that and get information. Easy installation, easy to use interface, how a lot of things on the Mac are consistent, whether you're blind or sighted. I mean, that's just kind of the way it is. It tends to work. They talk about top-notch customer support.
It's kind of surprising. I'm going to jump in here where Joe normally would, because I think on this, he and I agree. Yeah.
Look out, kids. This is going to be good. Let me get a chair. I gotta get close up on this.
Yeah, I'm not beating you up for once. Yeah.
No, I'm getting some popcorn. I'm good. All right, and go.
Uh-huh. And we are recording, so this is captured for posterity. I think that this is interesting in that the article talks about all of the great things about the Mac, but what I'm actually seeing is a lot of blind people who buy the Mac based on these points, you know, based on it has assistive technology built in, Apple has great customer service and that kind of thing, but they buy it with very little understanding that in addition to this being a new screen reader that you learn, it's a new operating system too. And we're still to some degree in the pioneer days as far as things being accessible on the Mac. If you do a lot of word processing, what do you use? That kind of thing. The support community is a bit smaller than it is for Windows. And again, I feel like a lot of blind people are getting the Mac because everyone is saying that blind people are getting the Mac. And so they're sort of jumping on the bandwagon, but they're not thinking about the fact that there is a learning curve here and there are some things that you're going to do differently than you would on Windows. And so then you see this rash of people selling their Macs. And they're a little disillusioned. And I don't think, at least for the most part, that, you know, it's the Mac's fault. I think it's more the fault of the person going in with illusions about how things are going to be and then finding out, oh, you know, I have to work a little bit for this. I have to learn some new things. So I do believe that the Mac is, in general, a very nice platform. There are some things that I would like to see done better here. But whenever you're making this decision about switching to the Mac, you've got to do your research, just as if you were buying new hardware for Windows or you were looking at a new screen reader. Right. This is not, the Mac doesn't solve everything for everyone, just as Windows doesn't. So think about your decision before you make it.
Okay. You heard it here, folks. Number 108 right there.
Let me add a little bit to that. As much as people complained about the start menu changing, Mac OS changes constantly and often, now yearly, in fact, as we'll see with Mountain Lion. And it's not that those things you learn with Mac OS don't transfer over, but even sighted individuals get very upset over changes in Mac OS. And VoiceOver changes either additions or changes in their keystrokes on many versions. So certainly the one that you used in Tiger is not what you're going to find in Mountain Lion this year. And that's a good thing. But at the same time, you also have a lot of built-in obsolescence. I'm looking at my iMac next to me from December 2010. I got a cheaper iMac. To do some of the things I wanted to do for this very podcast, I should have gotten a 27-inch, and I didn't know that. So I found out after I had bought a Mac that something I needed to do came a little later, and there's no way to upgrade that like I can on my PC box. So there's so many pieces to this. Buying a Mac and getting VoiceOver is fantastic, but there are also other parts of the Apple ecosystem that people don't realize that they have to contend with until they're in it, until they've had a generation change, until they've had an OS change. And what I'm more afraid of, and this is where I accidentally said iOS, as they start to move Mac OS into more iOS, there's a lot more limitations. And so some of the freedom that I enjoy on Windows may be, and I do quote may be, removed or severely limited in the Mac OS going forward, because Apple's user design is to get away from giving you some choice, because that way everything works better. And that bothers me in a lot of ways, because a lot of people want to be able to use this as your machine for employment. And they'll go, okay, I'm going to put Windows on it. Well, in a lot of cases, the drivers for older Macs are very difficult to use with Windows. And as Windows progresses, that may or may not change. So there's so much to this. And you really need to make an informed, intelligent buying decision and talk to your friends and go to the Mac store and feel VoiceOver and play with the voices and go to the keyboard help And I mean, that's the beauty of it, is that you don't have to make this choice in a vacuum like you do sometimes with Windows. You can actually go to a Mac store. You can see the hardware. You can ask if anything new is changing. You can ask an Apple guy. You can hit Command F5 and you can play around with it, and you can go and do things and learn about it. And Apple's website, it has a lot of information for VoiceOver users. But you do want to see in your community, do you have a Mac guru amongst your blindness community that you can rely upon to get some information? Because training is another side of this. And I've had to rely on other podcasts and other stuff to learn my Mac when I first got it.
I wanted to reiterate that we're not discouraging people from getting Macs. I love my MacBook. I absolutely love it. But don't go out and get this just because someone has made a statement, Macs are great for blind people. You know, this is a blanket statement that can be very generic. And I think that you as a consumer need to be empowered to make an informed decision rather than saying, hey, I just saw a sentence that says this is good for me, so I'm going to go get it and everything is magical. Insanely great.
Exactly. And I like the idea that people are buying it for accessibility rather than it doesn't get viruses anymore, because that's done for. But I'm seriously considering this new MacBook Air at a cheaper price if this is true, because this is just a rumor. But what do you think? Replacing your MacBook with a MacBook Air for $798 there, Ricky?
Well, you know, I love my MacBook Pro. I actually think it is still a decent size, but you can't argue with this price. $799 for something that is ultra portable, and we will continue to talk about ultrabooks. I think this is going to be the year of the ultrabook. So we had the year of the netbook in, what, 2009, I guess, 2008, 2009. Now it's become ultrabooks, and the idea is that you have something that's very portable but is also really powerful, or at least powerful enough to do general everyday tasks. I don't know that Apple is going to do this. This would be an interesting price point for them. I would honestly be a little surprised if they do this, but they may have to in order to compete with the other ultrabook pricing.
I'm kind of especially interested in this because I really do need to buy a laptop for when I'm on the road. I do not have one. And I would like to get a Mac, whether it's a MacBook Air or, you know, something. The price that they are right now is a little hard for me to justify. So it will hurt me to go and buy a Windows laptop because that's not really what I want. But I'm not sure I'm going to pay for, you know, the present MacBook or MacBook Air. So if they really did this, this would kind of be one of those things I'd have to consider.
I love Best Buy. When Windows 7 launched, there was a MacBook Pro with the price tag under it. And for the same price tag, there was a Windows PC, a Windows laptop, and a Windows netbook. Right?
Wow.
You know, that, I mean, for the exact same price. I think it's interesting philosophically if Apple feels like they have to reprice or re-strategize themselves to meet market demands, because it's so alien to me. I'm so used to Apple going, this is what it is. It's the new iPad. No, we don't believe in
and
naming conventions anymore.
And you don't care what it costs.
Yeah, you are going to go line up for this yesterday and break your piggy bank and run with all your quarters to the Apple store. It would just seem so strange. And unfortunately, it would also feel so much like after Steve Jobs left the first time. If you read the Steve Jobs book that we quote a lot on this show, that is exactly what happened. The clone era, all of that stuff while Steve was at Next. I don't want to say history repeating because I don't think it will, but it is very interesting to consider, okay, how about an iPad mini? We respect that people are buying these 7-point whatever tablets. Me too. That just doesn't feel like Apple to me.
Agreed. But there are people, apparently, according to this Next article, who do want an iPad mini. And, about 50% of the people surveyed said, I'd get one of those. But the primary reason for that would be the price point. Obviously, it's going to be less than a standard iPad. And so this is attractive to people because they could get a device that is, say, the size of a Kindle Fire or something like that, but it has the iPad features that everybody has grown to know and love. I'm not sure if Apple is going to do this, though. I mean, that remains to be seen. The only other reasons people were citing for wanting one of these was it would be a little more portable. And to me, I can't really wrap my head around it. There's not that much difference in size. I don't know that it's more portable. Perhaps it's easier to hold in the hand or something like that. But yeah. I don't know.
And a majority of those that were surveyed did not own a tablet at this time. So they would be coming into it for the first time. You know, I would think that the price would probably be the biggest reason. Of course, Siri and Retina display were mentioned. But, well, speaking of Siri, maybe coming to an Apple TV near you, according to this next article, a possible, well, some prototypes are supposedly out there.
As we record this, there's a rumor that Foxconn is getting ready to build it for 2013.
Right. And this is the Apple HD TV, not to be confused with, you know, the $99 device.
Good point, yes.
They're talking about, is this going to be 50 inches, 42 inches? What is it going to be? But there are all sorts of rumors in this article about how you can install apps on the TV. The price point is going to be probably twice as much as what you might pay for a comparable TV in the standard market. So, you know, say $1,600 for a 42-inch Wi-Fi enabled TV that you can put apps on.
That's
perhaps
not too
even
far
Siri.
Away from yes? a Samsung one, actually. I mean, that price point sounds astronomical, but compared to some of the better Samsung HD TVs that are web-enabled, that's actually right within the marketplace. And LG announced that they will be shipping televisions this month with Google TV built in. And, you know, Microsoft has the Play to be your cable box with Comcast. So eventually these companies are now fighting for the living room because of the absence of companies like Sony. And it does seem like everybody's kind of jostling around to see what the next big thing is. I don't know if I want an Apple TV. Well, excuse me, an Apple high definition, whatever we're going to call it, iTV.
Yeah. Well, you can't call it iTV because there's the company.
Yeah, the British
in the
company
UK that,
right.
that does
yeah.
this.
Yeah.
And that was actually the first thing I thought of back when rumors started of Apple building this thing. It's like, are they going to buy the iTV name from this company or are they going to call it the TV? You
yeah.
know?
Yeah, they'll come
if
up
you
with
have
some
the new
iView
iPad, why
or
not just
some
the,
other weird name, I'm sure. I'm just not sure. I mean, it moves Apple again into the appliance realm, no longer Apple computer. And that's another reason why I don't feel strongly about recommending Macs is Macs are such a small and getting even smaller part of Apple's business
right.
That I don't know how long they stay there.
For me, why do we want this? We have an Apple TV such that you can go out and choose whatever TV you want based on how it looks and the features that you care about and so on. And you can still use your Apple TV to play media on this device. Why do we need something specialized? You know, all these TVs are going to look the same.
Part of it feels like a dare since the book. Because there was always rumors about this TV for like 3 years, but after the Walter Isaacson book, it felt like we got to strike while the iron's hot. People really want this Apple TV. We should build it. You know, oh dude, yeah, we should build that thing. You know, and it's just picked up and more speed. It feels like since the book, because John C. Dvorak has talked about why they shouldn't do this for years. He's talked about an Apple TV for at least 5 years that I can think of, and he's given reasons why and why not. I say that also in the shadow of IKEA announcing a television cabinet that has a television built into it with a surround sound system and probably 15 torque wrenches to build the thing.
Can
and people
you
will just people will just buy
thing?
On name alone. When I used to sell televisions in the 90s, I used to have people that would come in, just show me Sony. It's all I'm going to buy is Sony. It was brand recognition for them. It was like Nike shoes. It was, I don't care that they hurt my feet. Michael Jordan wears them. So yeah. there was a little bit of Me Too going on in there as well. And so I think at this point there may have been plans, but there may be marketing that says let's do this, or there may be contracts that says let's do this. And I will also stress that I don't know that I could recommend that you buy the first of any Apple product. I don't care what it is. The first one usually is not the one you want. You want after they figured out all the bugs and go to the next one. I'm pointing at you, iPad 2. So it is definitely one of those things where, golly, I would not want a first gen of this thing.
Well, we'll move away from Apple, but I'll just mention that iOS 5.1.1 has been released. I don't know that there's anything huge there. There were some bug fixes and things, but nothing.
Yeah, some changes with AirPlay, fixes with that. I haven't even bothered to update, actually, but I will soon.
Anecdotally, it feels like my Wi-Fi is better. I don't know why I
really
say that, but on my iPad 1, I feel like I'm getting better Wi-Fi connection. I'm not dropping as much. And unless I've had something intensive in the background when I put the screen to sleep, I've not had that voiceover lag where you bring up the keyboard and it's, okay, are you there? Hello? Are you there? Ding, 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 ding. Oh, there's
Hello,
my
iPad,
letters.
Hello, iPad. It's me, Joe.
Yeah. So I've not had that as much. So it feels a little snappier. But again, I'm using older hardware. And for those of you who are using Macs, there was an update this week as well that did some changes to Safari and also took care of some of those nasty Flash issues by pretty much saying if it's an older version of Flash, we'll just not make it work. So you want to go get the latest version of Flash. So definitely check out where we have a lot of those stories. Triple Click Home. Yeah, go over to twitter.com/TripleClickHome. In fact, if you have a need for news more often, you would not believe the amount of stories that we tweet from Triple Click Home, from That Android Show, or Sarah Talk on Twitter. So between Sarah Talk weeklies, head over to Twitter and you'll get even more up-to-date news, probably more than you can read while hearing this podcast.
You know, we've talked several times today about releasing new products, that sort of thing. And one thing you really don't want to do is to make your users angry before the product is even released. Microsoft?
Yeah.
Really? You're going to cut Media Center out of Windows 8?
Okay, who uses Media Center first of
all?
I do. I'm guilty.
Yeah.
I do because my
I have
Xbox
a friend who
connects
does,
to
actually,
it.
Yeah.
But oh, wait a minute. Two of us on this podcast, of course, I being one of them, know somebody who actually uses Media Center? Ricky, do you use Media Center?
I don't use it myself, but I do know somebody who does. So, I mean, in some ways you would think, ha ha, Media Center, they're so cute, nobody uses it. But that appears not to be the case, especially given this outcry after Microsoft says, we're not including Windows Media Center in Windows 8. And the other bizarre and very unfortunate side effect is you're not going to be able to play DVDs natively either. You're going to have a program that does that. And yeah, there
used to be
are,
the way.
Yes. And there are manufacturers that include some sort of third-party DVD player in their image, but you can't necessarily count on this. And the article was talking about, so what? You mean my dad's going to go buy a Windows 8 machine and he's going to put a DVD in there and it's not going to play? And he's going to be like, what? What's wrong with this? Mm-hmm. I can't really wrap my head around why they're taking this out. And the theory is that they do have to license codecs for all of this stuff for Media Center, and they supposedly wanted to make things cheaper for the user and not have to pass along those licensing costs. But I still question this as a smart move. I don't think it is.
We're debating about whether Microsoft should bundle. You know, the Apple announced, what was it? I think it was in Snow Leopard that iDVD was done. They weren't going to update that anymore. They were like, it's there, you can have it. But most of our systems will not ship with an optical drive anymore anyway, so hooray. And there was a minor outcry in the Mac community. But then there were also like 15 other apps out there that did it too. And we're coming up on the 1 billionth download of VLC Media Player. I don't know. I get Microsoft's point here, and I certainly am for making Windows cheaper. That's awesome. And with like what they did with Windows Live Essentials, where they said, you know what? we're not going to stick Movie Gallery in there. Nobody ever goes there anyway. And we're not going to stick, you know, Live Writer in there. We're not going to stick Family Center, Safety Center in there. That's just going to be a Windows Live Essentials download. So it doesn't feel like it's out of sync for Microsoft. It just feels kind of weird that something that has been there for many, many years, going back to Windows XP Media Center Edition, is kind of sort of gone. But I'm okay with being able to download it from the Microsoft Store. I like what Mary Jo Foley and Paul Thurrott said on Windows Weekly. It'll be an ultimate extras download for Vista.
There you go.
Continuing to follow up on things we talked about last week, we were talking about different cloud storage options and, you know, comparing them and how they work. And one of the things that came up was you're going to use multiple sites. You're going to use SkyDrive and Dropbox. This next article, and of course Apple's iCloud service, this next article talks about, you know, the foolishness of basically fighting over my system is better than your system. Because the truth of the matter is, we're probably going to use multiple systems for different things.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Right now, I have both Dropbox and SkyDrive. I'll be getting Google Drive at some point, whenever it says that my drive is ready. This was, when I was looking at it a couple of weeks ago, not rolled out to all users. And so some people would go to their Google accounts and try to access this, and it would say, no, it's not ready yet. So I'm still waiting for mine. I like SkyDrive. I have, for one thing, more space with SkyDrive than I do with Dropbox right now. And there are iOS and Android apps in addition to the PC client, but I still use Dropbox because a lot of the other people that I know use Dropbox. And whenever we need to share documents or something like that, Dropbox is the way to go there. And of course, there's iCloud for doing various things like backing up, say, music, contacts, all of
calendar.
Those things, calendar for your iDevice. And so to me, this is kind of just as silly as saying there's one operating system or one screen reader to rule them all. I don't think
social
there's
network.
One cloud service to rule them all. Yeah, social networking is another example. Why do we feel like we have to choose a single thing and stick with that, even though there may be limitations or features that are available elsewhere? Why not? The more the merrier.
No, there's only one screen reader, says the guy who's using a Windows screen reader in an iPhone. We all are hypocrites. It's what we're good at. I tell you this.
Yeah. Well, Joe, what do you think about this next story? Microsoft's developing a Kinect-like controller that uses sound waves.
When I first heard sound wave, I thought Transformers. No, end of line, EOLshow.com. Sorry. The idea that Microsoft is going to reinterpret the Kinect is interesting. They have an opportunity in Windows 8 and with Windows versions of the Kinect to start again, because there was a conversation recently on one of my video game podcasts about a Kinect 2 for the Xbox 360. And after you've sold 10 million of the things, you're not going to convince everybody to go buy another 10 million of them for the Kinect 2. So the Kinect that you have on the Xbox is as good as it's going to get until the next Xbox, which is rumored for 2013, and then you can, have the improved hardware. Hardware is dangerous, so I like the concept of this, but having a Kinect, it's got to be a lot better, because as we demonstrated back on episode 100, it only uses certain commands. It only uses what's available on screen. It only uses what you can do in a certain screen. There's no contextuality to it, like Siri. Siri has the ability to kind of, sort of, figure out what you're going for, and Microsoft is what you see is what you get. That's it. That's how this is going to work. So if it's a little bit more flexible, then I'm totally down with that.
And wouldn't it be, though? Because basically this is still in its infancy, but what they're doing is they're using somehow the microphone and speakers built into your laptop in order to interpret gestures. So how does this work? I mean, I thought the idea was, I thought
it doesn't
idea
interpret
was
the
that...
gestures I make at it now, including the nasty ones. But it sees my dog. I can't figure this out. It sometimes doesn't see that I've raised my hand, but somehow it sees Benji sitting right next to me. So
well, I guess
that's
he's got his tail
too.
Waving around or something.
I guess so, or the Kinect was made for shorter people, which is possible. There's all sorts of websites out there that'll tell you about what the Kinect will and will not see. In fact, we've talked about that wearing it and stuff. The Kinect, because of the infrared way that it maps your body, if you go out into bright daylight, that kind of sort of blinds the Kinect. So there's a lot of information out there about, you know, this sound thing would help because it would give the Kinect even more information than relying upon mapping software from an infrared device. Again, it's all theoretical. The SDKs are out there. There are people really, really working with this technology. And I think over time, like Siri, it just will fade into the background. You would just go, oh, yeah, that makes sense, blah, 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 and on and on and on. Of course, we say that until Me goes away at the end of the month. So,
yeah.
Tell Me.
On June 1st, we are discontinuing the 1-800-555-TEL service. You'll still be able to get sports, news, business search, and everything else you're looking for by visiting www.bing.com on your PC or mobile device.
Say a city and state, or say a service, like directions.
That's a shame. Good old Tell Me. It was a great service, but looks like June 1st is when Tell Me goes away. That's a shame.
Well, let's talk about social media for a little bit. This next article was one that I was particularly interested in because I do a lot of tweeting from the Sarotalk account. And this is four ways that you can keep business from being a menace on Twitter. Well, heaven help us. We don't want for Sarotalk to be a menace on Twitter at all. First of all, the research data done by a company, Highbeam, the latest quarterly scores for social media index show that Twitter hit 55.17% of total media attention. Facebook was at 41.8% and LinkedIn is at 2.23%. Definitely Twitter is at the top of that list. But the trick here is a lot of businesses want to use Twitter to get their message out, and that's fine. That's a good thing. There's not a thing wrong with that. But Twitter is not, at its core, a business site. It really is for socialization, social media. And so a business has to be careful not to be spammy or, as this article says, creepy when tweeting. And there are some really interesting things here. The first one I especially think is true, which is to think quality over quantity. Yeah, I could send out 50 tweets in an hour, but number one, that's a lot of tweets. And number two, are the articles that I'm tweeting anything that you would really want to read? I try to tweet most of the things that we're going to talk about on the show or that I'm pretty sure we are, but not always. Sometimes I will see an article and think, you know, I don't know if that's really going to, that may fit that Android show or that may fit something else. But I'm going to go ahead and send it out because it's a good article. But definitely, I pass over a lot of things as well for the Sarotalk feed.
Yeah.
And I know, Joe, you do some of this as well with some of the other podcast feeds. I'm sure you've walked this tightrope as well.
And of course, the other big takeaway from this is that you have to be human. You can't be bot-like. Yeah. You know, Twitter at its core is about interacting with people. So if somebody asks you a question, you don't necessarily respond with some generic link that tells them nothing or some generic statement that's like, our company is so great. If they're asking you a question, you've got to provide quality feedback so that they feel like they really are talking to a human because that's what Twitter is all about. And the article also talks about if you've got somebody who is, you know, the person responsible for your tweet feed, you could perhaps put their photo in the bio, but even more importantly, have a bio about your company that actually says something about your company, not just our company is named Nuco, for example. And
right. yeah.
That's the end. You wanna give people who stumble across your Twitter page some idea of what it is that you do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's okay to let people know, hey, in some cases, this person is the social media specialist for this company. That was another thing the article mentioned. You know, there's nothing wrong with having a name to that job in some situations. So some really good, interesting things there to take a look at, and you can check out that article in our show notes over at sarotalk.com. In our last general tech story this week, Social Security Administration is now providing online statements. So you can go online and view your statements. Kind of the trend of getting rid of paper, going paperless. The banks are doing it. Everyone's doing it. Of course, this is not specifically an AT story, but for us as blind people, I mean, this is a good thing because obviously we have more access to our information. Scanning numbers can be the trickiest thing
or
ever.
Or there's tables.
If there's anything
Here's absolutely how your benefits work out with a blah, 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 blah. 15,
47, 19,
wait a minute, I'm not even sure where that number goes.
None of these things match up to anything exactly.
All right.
I'm using my table commands, and they do nothing.
No. And the columns are so close together that that doesn't decolumnize.
Oh, yes. You might end up with some best number that says, you owe 1,367,000. And it was just like all these numbers strung
wait,
together.
Let me go to verbosity. Let me do this one by one. Hold on.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Does this mean I have an overpayment? No, wait. No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
Nah. Ick. Not that any of us have ever read those letters before in our college days or nothing. That right. Never happened. You know, the other thing is, that joke works 15 years ago as it does today. It's just ever present. Thank you, government.
Yes, yes, indeed. Hey, we talked about the iPhone 5 book, and Dr. Robert Carter over on the Tech Doctor podcast did an interview with Anna Dresner discussing the book. So I actually haven't had a chance to listen to this podcast yet, but I certainly intend to. I've got kind of a busy weekend, but if I can sneak in some time, I'm going to sit down and give that a listen. So be very, very good podcast, I'm sure.
Indeed.
Robert does
it,
a great job
is.
of interviews. Yeah. For those of you who use Station Playlist Studio in broadcasting, whether you're using JAWS or WindowEyes, actually, Brian Hartgen is working on updating the JAWS scripts, which if you have ever used Station Playlist, his scripts are quite good. They really add some functionality to the program in some cases that I'm not sure that early would have if you didn't have the scripts at all. And in some cases, or in other cases, just makes things easier to use. The really cool thing about this project is that Brian, working on the JAWS scripts, has worked very closely with Jeff Bishop, working on the WindowEyes scripts. So the two sets of scripts, or in WindowEyes' case, apps, if you prefer, actually are very similar. There are some differences as well, but these guys have really collaborated and I think made some excellent, some of the best case examples of what really good script writing can do. Those gentlemen are both top-notch script writers for the screen readers that they use. And Brian urges you to drop some feedback to him. If you want to see some things added, now's the time to get those requests in. And he's really going to work on some updating facilities and some bug tracker information. And so a lot of work going in there.
And if I remember right, free. Aren't those scripts free?
Absolutely, they are free.
I think that's important because Brian has offered some other wonderful scripts over the years that have been really good to buy, especially in the beginning of iTunes. You know, JTunes was very helpful. And Brian has done some amazing work there. And a big fan of TNT Consulting and the gang. And Jeff has been a big flag waver for WindowEyes, and rightfully so. And, you know, all the things over at App Central are worth a look. It's certainly, again, we said earlier in this podcast, one screen reader cannot rule them all. And it also takes a mountain of people to be able to get you some of these things accessible. So acknowledge the work that these guys are doing because it keeps them going to do these things because they know there's an audience out there. But feedback can sometimes in the right places really help get you motivated for a project. And we do a lot of sniping on the internet and occasionally on this show, in fact. But I think it's important that everybody know that we respect highly the work that people are doing for projects that are, you know, free, but also for those that are doing them for a monetary value, especially when it's at the price that the community can afford. I think we should do more supporting for things like that. And while we're on the same length here, NVDA has a new podcast. We talked about the Tech Doctor one. So we'll have a link here in the show notes to the new NVDA podcast. It also helps explain the work that those guys are doing. And it gives you an idea that it takes a whole bunch of time and a lot of smart people to put those ones and zeros together to make all this stuff work.
And just as soon as they have an RSS feed for that podcast, it will be on iBlink Radio. So keep a lookout for that as well.
Speaking of podcasts, the Access Talk crew over in the UK, they were bitten by the PodTrack bug, just as many of us were. We talked about that earlier in the show. They have actually chosen to create a new feed, and you can find the link to that feed for subscribing to Access Talk UK in our show notes. And you definitely want to check out what these guys are doing, because they're fantastic, very knowledgeable, they're tech enthusiasts, and just a pleasure to listen to.
And finally, in our last bit of assistive tech news for this week, the Victor Reader Stream has an update, version 3.5. There's several things in there, especially, I think, some fixes for some go-to-time issues in different file formats that were causing some problems. They fixed those. Also, you can adjust tone and pitch a little bit more in your listening. So if you have the HumanWare Companion, you can easily update there. Otherwise, we will provide a link to actually just download the file, and you can check that out as well. You know, you can certainly listen to Serospectives every month. We do This Month in Assistive Tech. Lisa Salinger and her co-host Steve Sazen do a great job. It was really kind of interesting. I was listening to the last one that they did, and I actually was able to be present during the AE presentation. I was in the chat room. And it's so interesting because those guys will take articles that we've talked about on Serotalk, and they will recap some of them. And the take that the panel had, Pratik Patel and Rick Harmon and Lisa and Steve, sometimes they took a completely different view of a story than Ricky, Joe, and I did on the podcast. And it's kind of interesting to listen to that different perspective on Serospective. So just because you've heard these stories once, don't think, oh, well, you know, I've already heard that stuff, I don't want to hear it again. You'll hear it in a completely fresh approach. So go give Serospectives a listen.
Especially with people who have a lot of experience, like Mika Paiakala for the March wrap-up edition. Yeah. We've had some really great guests on that show doing some fantastic interpretations on what they see is important about these stories. And Serospectives is the community's voice, not Serotalk. Right. So when you hear us ramble on and on and on about a story, understand that we respect that other people might have differing views, and that's what Serospectives does. We also want to point you to High Contrast Episode 1, released right now in the Serotalk feed. So if you liked what you heard, and we actually had a couple of positive comments about the little snippet that we played in the last podcast, go listen to the new pilot for High Contrast, starring Rodney Egger over at Tech Access Weekly, and of course Maury Hill, AI Squared, and Jeremy Curry from GW Micro. Those guys are really good at explaining their low vision loss and what it takes for them to be able to do the things that they do. And I think it brings a good balance, because sometimes low vision people are stuck in the middle. They don't really have the ability to interact with sighted people fully. And sometimes we don't always understand what it's like to be totally blind. So it's its own kind of blindness in a way, because I identify myself as legally blind. And so we're hoping to tackle a lot of those conversations and even talk about what it's like to go from one side to another, to go from someone who has had sight to losing their vision to what they interpret would be what happens when they go totally blind, because that's a whole nother perspective than someone who was born blind and has accepted their vision loss and what they, you know, feel about it. So those conversations we're looking forward to tackling at a future podcast. But give High Contrast a listen. We're really, really proud of that show.
Coming up after the break, we've got your emails and eye reports, and perhaps we'll talk a little about exercise here on the Saratok Podcast Network.
Looking for a cross-platform solution to quickly convert printed materials and PDFs into text, MP3, or DAISY formats? Check out Saratok's DocuScan Plus. For just $299, use DocuScan Plus on your Windows or Mac computer. Store documents in the cloud for easy retrieval and access them from anywhere. For more information, visit www.docuscanplus.com.
Go, Caleb!
Come on, hit a homer, Jesse!
Let's go, guys!
Hey, did you guys know that kids who play sports earn more money when they grow up?
Of course. I knew that.
Hey, did you guys know that kids who read books have a bigger vocabulary?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Wow, jinx. Did you guys know that friendly children have more friends?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's true. I knew that. Did you guys know that winter babies are better at music?
Everyone knows that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's pretty obvious.
Yeah,
yeah.
So
yeah.
Obvious.
Oh, hey, guys, did you know that most people think they're using the right car seat for their kid, but they're not?
Huh, I didn't know that.
I'm pretty sure I knew that.
I'm pretty sure you didn't.
Parents who really know it all know for sure that their child is in the right car seat at the right age and size. Visit safercar.gov/the right seat to make sure your child is protected. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Saratok, and this is the portion of the program where we hear from everyone out there about what you thought about our stories or the past episodes in this thing called, let me lift it, the mailbag.
Ah, be careful.
Yes.
Be careful. It's going to split open, and we're going to be buried in audio files. And those things are heavier than you'd think. We do have an email that I'd like to start out with, and this comes from Kevin Berry. Joe, last week you were talking about DirecTV, and Kevin writes in to let us know that both of the DirecTV iOS apps are completely accessible. This means not accessible with a bunch of workarounds where you kind of have to dance around in the full moon and spin your head around and stuff like that. You can actually program a DVR from anywhere. You can do the same with the iPad app, and you can also get control over networked boxes, and you can get some live playback there on the iPad as well. So thank you, Kevin, for letting us know that the DirecTV apps are indeed accessible.
Happy to be wrong. Let me say this. Guys, I am absolutely happy to be wrong. I was just relaying information that had come from Twitter that people had sent to me when I had talked about having to make the switch from what I had planned on buying, which was DirecTV, to Dish, because they wanted to charge an exorbitant fee for starting my service. But guys, whenever we've missed something, we are happy to take corrections on this show. Send it in with an iReport or email or let us know on Twitter. We are absolutely glad to be able to say that something is more accessible for a change. Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, that's happy news. We love that.
Yeah. Well, we have a new voice. Actually, several new voices are coming into our iReport inbox, and we love that, actually. This first one is from Veronica, who has some phobias she wants to share with us.
Veronica in California, and I wanted to submit in my iReport to the Saratok podcast, and you guys are talking about phobias. And Lisa, I agree with you on the not liking the feel of emery boards. Ooh, just the feel of them is like, ooh. And I hate the sound of another phobia of mine is I hate the sound of styrofoam. Not like the styrofoam cups or plates or anything like that, but the styrofoam that's in a package, like when you get a package and you see like those little styrofoam pieces, and then when you're trying to get to the item inside the package, it makes all kinds of noise and ooh, ooh, yeah. So those are mine. Those are my phobias. As always, you guys do an awesome job. This is one of my favorite shows to listen to, and I look forward to it every week. So keep up the good work, and can't wait for the next one.
Well, Veronica, you know, I thought about getting some styrofoam, some of those little peanuts, and playing with them on the show, but that would really not be very nice, and I would actually not do that to you at all. But I think we've all, it sounds like we all kind of have those little things, whether it's, you know, rubbing your, not letting your feet touch if you're wearing socks. Ooh, that's kind of one for me there.
Oh, no. Interesting. I didn't know about that one.
Oh, yeah. Jamie, again, on the couch. How do you feel about, you know? Wow.
It's balloons for me. The sound of rubbing your hand across a balloon and it makes that squeaky sound and you just know it's going to pop at any moment, but you don't know when.
Balloon fears are common. There are a lot of people who have balloon fears. That's not surprising, actually.
This next iReport is from Randy, who talks about the smell of books.
Hi, this is Randy Shelton. I was just commenting on Podcast 106 and all the talk lately about old records and books. I remember that well. And the smell of them, there was nothing better than coming home and finding all those old books, those boxes sitting there waiting to be opened. And I used to take a fork and try to push the buckle up when the strap wouldn't give and open up the book or the record, and there was nothing better. And as for the smartphones, I just got my iPhone about 6 months ago, and I mainly use it for the instant access. Like, I have USA Today on it and different games that I love to play with people or by myself. It's a great way to pass the time. And, of course, chatting, texting, the Heytel app is one of my favorites. I don't use it too often for books and music. Sometimes I'll put a book from Bookshare on there and listen to Read to Go, but it's not, that's not my main use for the iPhone. So really enjoy the podcast. They're a lot of fun to listen to and a lot of great information, so keep it up.
Wow, I'm really kind of glad we got into this whole discussion of pleasant olfactory sensations, shall we say, of the smell of old records and Braille books and probably print books as well in many of our cases. There's, you know, you walk into a classroom, a school has a smell all its own. It's
yes, it
absolutely
does.
Absolutely. The chalk and paper and the whole night glue.
It's hard to tell. Glue, yeah. It's
but even Braille libraries.
I think we should have the smell of the month club.
Oh, yeah. That awesome.
Braille
awesome.
Libraries, where I used to work in Austin. It was the Braille Library for Chris Cole before it became the Assistive Technology Unit.
Yes, and I talked about that very library, I think, a couple of episodes ago, where you just walk in and you could smell it.
Smell, yeah. And even after we removed the bookcases a couple of years out, it still kind of had that booky smell, and it was just unique. You know, there was just nothing like that particular smell.
So for $14.95, you can buy Sarotech's new Scratch and Sniff book.
Oh, this sounds like an April Fool's joke in the making. This
you could totally burn candles that this is book scent. This is old record.
Mm. 5-year-old paperback, wow. 20-year-old thermoform.
Ooh, thermoform. That totally has a unique smell.
It does.
It is awesome. How many people write us in and go, I know too. Oh, you know, we really honestly, guys, had no idea when we started to go down memory road that we'd have so many of you guys join us on the path to the Emerald City.
All right. So, resources at sarotalk.com. Go to the blog, leave a comment there, or call 866-997-2522. That one almost got me for a second.
I was about to say, you remembered it better than I, sir. Congrats.
866-997-2522, or Blab if you prefer. Also, if you have an iOS or an Android device, phone preferably, you can leave an iReport, and we would love to hear those as well. Keep those comments coming. It's time now for Roundabout. Well, this week's story is about a paralyzed woman, a paraplegic from England, from Britain, who ran a London marathon. Claire Lomas is her name. She was paralyzed for 5 years, or has been paralyzed for 5 years. And she was a pro horse rider, and in an accident in 2007, was paralyzed from the chest down. She received a $75,000 bionic suit in January, and I'm almost positive we covered the story of this suit being made available.
Yes, I believe we did.
Yeah. I'm not sure if this was the same one that I kind of went on a rant because they designed the suit and then the maintenance contract ran out and they didn't think they were going to be able to continue servicing it.
I think this is different. Okay. So we've covered a couple of things like this.
Right. She actually started with 30 steps a day. She uses two canes along with this this suit. But in order to run this 26.2-mile marathon, or I suppose I should say complete the marathon, she took 55,000 steps. Pretty amazing. Yeah.
What powered this thing? I mean, I think that she had like a flotilla of batteries behind her or something.
It doesn't mention exactly how that works, but there is kind of a hydraulics-esque sound to this thing
when it
lifts each leg and then places it down again.
Sounds like Ed 209 for RoboCop. No, I'm kidding.
You know, actually that is mentioned in the article. Yeah. Yes.
No way.
It is.
Yes.
Yep, it is.
That's awesome. That is. Remember, the robot uprising starts with the cyborgs. We have to watch for the cyborgs. That's how we know that the robots are coming for us. Yeah. That's what the Roombas told me. That's how I know.
Gotta be careful with those things.
Absolutely.
They run while you're sleeping, you know, so you never know what it is they're going
to
come in and do.
And then they talk to the Google self-driving cars in Nevada. It's a conspiracy. I'm telling you that the machines
are
ready.
You got the Google glasses that watch
they're taking
everything,
pictures and feeding information to the Roombas.
So Joe and Ricky are going to go work on the next episode of EOL now.
Actually, they've
been working on the next episode all podcast long. You have no idea.
Our pre-show was a bunch of gobbledygook that even we barely understood.
Jamie will have a working knowledge of The Simpsons and Star Trek before this is all over. I'm telling you guys, this is just what happens.
And Blade Runner.
I love EOL. I don't understand a third of it, but
neither
I love it. It is. yeah, exactly. That is going to wrap up the news, but don't go away because I actually have an interview with Joshua Loya and Carrie Hoth of the Cisco Academy for the Visually Impaired. A very interesting interview. I think you'll enjoy it a lot.
Yeah, former third chair of the EOL, by the way. Sorry, go
That's
ahead.
That's right. Exactly. Not that we're plugging or anything.
No.
No, EOL and he actually did appear on Sarah Spectives for one show as well.
Oh, that's true.
Joshua, in fact.
Yeah.
A couple? Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good.
So no stranger to those of you listening to SPN, definitely. But stick around for that, everybody.
Until next time, have a great week.
Thanks for listening.
Well, this week on Serotalk, we are joined by Carrie Hoth and Joshua Loya. And today, we're going to talk about the Cisco Academy for the Vision Impaired. First of all, Carrie, welcome to the podcast.
Hi.
Excellent. Why don't you go ahead? Now, you are an instructor for the Academy. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm the primary instructor for the Academy. We, at the moment, have one paid member of staff, which is myself, and we have another number of volunteer instructors that deliver classes and to our students. So, yes.
Joshua Loya, of course, joins us as a student from the Academy. And Joshua, you've been on End of Line. So welcome to the Serotalk Podcast Network again.
Thank you, Jamie. Glad to be here.
So how did you, let's start with you, Joshua, and ask, how did you get in contact with the Academy? How did you find out about it?
I actually originally heard of the Cisco Academy perusing the archives of Blind Cool Tech. There's a podcast that Grace and a number one of the instructors and a number of the other instructors at CAVI had recorded talking about what the Academy offered. And one of the things I was pondering is the idea that I wanted to have some additional job skills, some additional marketable things to offer and to kind of get my edge, you know, with regards to my sighted counterparts. And looking at something that I could do online or something that was easily accessible regardless of geography. And that was the biggest thing that attracted me to CAVI, is that it was within reach financially and also was available regardless of the geography, and really was, you know, it offered a lot of skills and instruction that I think is well suited to a number of people, especially myself, I guess, at that particular juncture.
Very good. Carrie, let's bring you back in. And why don't you just share with us what are some of the subjects that are taught there at from the Academy?
Okay. At the Academy, we currently teach four courses. Mm-hmm. We have CCNA Exploration, which is a high-level networking course. We have CCNA Discovery, which is an intro to networking. We have IT Essentials, which is a preparation course for the A-plus certification, and Introduction to Command Line Linux, which is a new course that we have started teaching this semester. So they're the four courses we offer. Basically, the CCNA Discovery is designed for people who are just getting used to networks. They really don't know a lot about networking at all. They might have a you know, home router and connect some things in. CCNA Exploration, we go into the advanced topics such as subnetting and binary to decimal and all that computer science-y sort of stuff. The IT Essentials prepares you for A+, and the Introduction to Command Line Linux is meant to make you feel comfortable at a Linux command line. And that's essentially the four courses we have at the moment. We do have plans to expand in future.
Very good. Joshua, what really struck you as especially good, I guess, about the Academy? What kind of stands out in your mind as far as what they provide?
I think the biggest thing that when I reflect on, you know, what I've learned in CAVI so far, and one of the things I really appreciate is the fact that all of the instructors, Carrie and the other instructors available, are really good about answering questions. You know, regardless of your level of experience, I mean, obviously there's some basic skills that you're expected to have, but that said, you know, there is no question that is dismissed as being stupid or something that, you know, gosh, you should know this. It's definitely a really good learning environment. So that, you know, I had a question once about file systems or something, and I don't remember the specifics anymore, but the way it was responded to and answered was very respectful, and I was able to get that information without actually feeling like I was asking a question that I should know already. And I think that is probably really important for people when they're learning a new skill, regardless of their level of experience. Sometimes when you're getting into technical things, it can be a little bit intimidating. I think that's having that free and open atmosphere is especially good.
Now, as I was looking at the website, it appears that there are some students on site as well as online students. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, that's correct. The students who are on site, we actually this semester have two local students, and they are here in Perth, which is where the actual academy is based. We can have anywhere from 0 to 6 or 7 local students. The majority of our students, however, are international. Most of them this semester are from Canada and the US. We also have Sri Lankan students. We have students from India. We've had students from Egypt, Africa. We're looking at having students from the Philippines. So it's certainly an international reach. The local students are certainly important, but they are treated no less importantly than our international students that we're teaching from a distance. We try to make sure that all of our students get as much of a shot at resources as possible, and we adapt to the different groups of students.
So I assume that you guys use all of the different means, such as live chat and that sort of thing, as far as classroom participation and discussion. Is that right?
Well, we use Ventrilo for our class, and there's a very good technical reason for that. Ventrilo will actually read the chat to you automatically if you're an instructor. So if we're marking a quiz, we can ask a question, turn on the text-to-speech feature, and it will read that quiz to us, whichever window we're in. So the lectures are provided on Ventrilo. One-to-one support is provided by Skype, and social gatherings often occur on TeamTalk, Zello, and Haytel.
So you've got the bases covered then, it sounds like. That's excellent. Joshua, what's your experience as far as interacting with instructors and other students? I assume absolutely no challenges whatsoever from accessibility standpoint.
Certainly not. All of the instructors are either completely blind or significantly visually impaired. So, you know, we all use the same access solutions. And, you know, so as far as that goes, there is nothing that I have been expected to do as a student that has been a challenge accessibility-wise. You know, so as far as that goes, I think the biggest thing is making sure you have an up-to-date version of the screen reader you're using and have some basic skills with it. But beyond that, assuming you have a current version of your screen reader and have a reasonable level of skill, you shouldn't run into any accessibility issues with regards to the course.
Does it really matter what platform you're on, Mac or Windows? Or, well, I guess it, yeah, probably wouldn't. Right?
Yeah, it would, okay. Because at this time, these are PC-based courses.
Okay.
So while certainly there are people who use Macs that are students, when they are participating in course proceedings, it's important that they're running, at the very least, Windows on a virtual machine, or I guess in the case of the Linux course, that they have access to a Linux virtual machine. So, you know, at this time, you know, the A+ certification is primarily designed to assist people in supporting Windows machines. So that's probably worth noting that while the Mac is nice, and I actually love my Mac because I'm a Mac user as well, that would not be helpful for the courses offered currently.
What courses have you taken so far?
This is actually my first semester with CAVI, and I'm currently enrolled in the IT Essentials course. I think the biggest thing that attracted me to the course was the fact that not only would I learn how to troubleshoot and configure software, but I would also learn how to piece together the hardware of a system myself. And that's something, through the help of CAVI, I've been able to do a little bit more of. That was probably the biggest deficit in my knowledge computer-wise, is being able to know how to put a computer together from scratch, you know, with the motherboard, and even so far as to even putting in a new processor onto a motherboard completely independently, near as much as can be done.
Excellent. Carrie, what courses are you guys looking at? I know you mentioned that, you know, you are looking at other things. What can you share with us at this time?
Well, we're certainly looking at branching out into running different courses. We're looking at doing an HTML and CSS course for the blind, and that will concentrate on how to get pages to actually look good, as well as being coded well and be acceptable to sighted viewers and vision impaired viewers as well. And we'll also be, for example, in that course, we'll also be encouraging those who have iPads, for example, to use their iPad to feel what the pages look like and what the various things do to those pages. We're currently looking into running a asterisk PBX course, and there is talk of a free switch course. To clarify the reason why we're not providing Mac courses, our course material is actually donated to the Academy by the organizations that are we're running the courses for. So Cisco actually donates the use of the course material to us. Unfortunately, we were unable to come to a satisfactory agreement with Apple's legal department that would be financially acceptable to our students, which is why we're not running Apple courses at this time.
Okay. What is the cost of each course? Does it vary? Are they fairly consistent?
Basically, there is the courses are $500 per course, and that covers a 6-month course. Okay. There are, however, scholarships for students who are paying out of pocket, and that will tend to reduce the course cost down to $150. You talk to us at application time and discuss your situation, and if you're paying out of pocket, you receive what we call the scholarship, and you do get the discount rate of $150 per course. To give you some idea, the courses like the Exploration 1 course and the IT Essentials course, you're looking at $2,000 to $5,000 to do these courses commercially. They're not cheap courses,
right.
So we're certainly providing a significant discount.
That's excellent. Joshua, why don't you give us some information about where a person who's interested can go to check out the information that the Academy provides?
Certainly. I would say if you're interested in applying for courses, in fact, I think in admissions applications will be being taken next month in June, you would want to go to ciscovision.org. That's ciscovision.org. And alternatively, there is some additional information at qcat.org. That's qcat.org.
I think as a testament to the commitment of the instructors in this program, it should be noted that Carrie, who is in Australia, is doing this interview at 1 a.m. in the morning. So my hat is off to you, Carrie, and thank you for being willing to take your time to join us on the podcast.
Absolutely. And one final point I'd like to add is if you do go to qcat.org, which is the site that Joshua has just mentioned, all of our lecture recordings and our actual course notes and stuff are freely downloadable. So if anybody would like to have a listen to the sort of work we do, we have about 3 or 4 years worth of coursework all up there on the website, and anybody's welcome to drop into the student resources section and pull down some sample lectures, and that really gives you the chance to decide whether our mode of teaching and stuff is for you.
That's an excellent resource. That's great news. Joshua, as I said earlier, you've been no stranger to the network. You've been on a couple of Serospectives episodes, so I'd like to thank you for joining us again on the Serotalk podcast.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be back, Jamie.
We've been visiting with Joshua Loya and Carrie Hoth about the Cisco Academy for the Visually Impaired right here on the Serotalk podcast.
You've been listening to Serotalk. Visit us at www.serotalk.com. Send us an email at resources@serotalk.com. Send us an iReport with iBlink Radio, available in the Apple App Store and the Android Market. Or leave a voicemail at 866-997-BLAB. That's 2522. We may read your email or play your voicemail in the next podcast. Join us next week as we explore all that life and the internet have to offer. Until then, may you have an accessible digital life.